Meditations with Ryan Slomak.
Hello and greetings. Welcome to episode 18 of Meditations with Ryan Slomak. This is a podcast dedicated to making space for conversation with interesting people to see what kind of interesting stuff we can pick up along the way. On today's episode, it's very special to me. It is with Lawrence Katz, the guitarist for the famed band The Muddy Muddy Bosstones, and unabashedly, one of my favorite humans and one of my favorite bands of all time. In this conversation, we talk about his experience navigating the music scene of the 90s, getting recognized by the Muddy Muddy Bosstones, and his experience playing with them for over two decades, his transition behind the mixer to open his own studio and record other bands, and lastly, his willingness to offer his musical expertise to the community at large, which is pretty amazing. So without further ado, why don't we just jump into this? Here is Lawrence Katz. So Lawrence, thanks for joining me. And it's I know people at home can't see anything, but I get this beautiful view of your studio, and I'm jealous. I'm not in Atlanta right now.
There you go. This is a work in progress, but coming together nicely. A long time coming.
That's awesome. And one of the things that I was really curious about just talking to you about is you. I've met a lot of nomadic musicians in my life. And as I was doing research on you, I think you take the cake. I mean, you've lived on every coast. You've traveled the globe consistently. And even when it seems like things slow down, you still find a way to move. Like, it's like your
Fair.
Superpower.
Yeah. Whether it's by choice or by necessity. But I mean, you know, look, the road thing. Well, a couple things. So I left home to go to college, went to Berklee College of Music in Boston. Then I came back here to Atlanta, which is a place that I felt a little bit stifled by on both ends, and then saw opportunity in Los Angeles. And at the time, we're talking about mid-90s, Atlanta was not. And, you know, there were very few places to go to, you know, be a part of the music business scene, I suppose. Right. So you can make music anywhere. But, you know, at the time, New York or Los Angeles seemed to be the kind of big scenes for music. So I moved out there and I was there the better part of 25 years. So and, you know, in terms of having a residence, that was where that's probably been the place I've lived the longest on some level, but always hubbing out of there to do touring stuff.
Yeah. Well, and you have to have home. I guess that was just kind of what I was curious about is like, you know, you lived in Boston, you lived in outside of Philly, you lived in Atlanta, yep. You lived in LA. Is Atlanta what you would kind of consider home? Like or maybe the better question is there a place that feels like home to you just like geographically?
Maybe after moving so much, the answer would be no. I guess there's a sense of, you know, geography, topography that resonates with me about being in Atlanta that is kind of just a part of me just from having grown up here. But, you know, Los Angeles is kind of where my community of people exist even still on some level, but I guess post COVID, you know, there's, you know, nowhere is anywhere anymore. Yeah, I mean, coming back here, it's a little harder to get, you know, integrated into any sort of community, particularly the kind of community that I built in Los Angeles. But at the same time, now community exists on the internet. So it's, you know, it's tricky. The thing I loved about Los Angeles was just that you're surrounded by people that do what you do and kind of understand the language. And, you know, that's a huge plus that I have yet to kind of really find here in Atlanta.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to your time in LA, but I want to take even a step further back. Just your, you know, you started really playing guitar in high school, right? Like that.
Essentially. Yeah.
Yeah,
I got serious about it, I suppose.
And then you decided to go to Berklee. At what point did you like decide in your sort of like creative journey that like focusing on the guitar was what you wanted your career to be? Like, what was that sort of like linchpin?
I think that I don't know that I connected it with career necessarily. because I was not really disciplined or focused in that sense. You know, in high school, I was, you know, that just was the thing that kind of resonated with me. So I followed it. My parents, who were very collegiate kind of intellectuals, you know, my mom went to Smith and my dad went to Penn. It was, and my brother went to Penn, and I barely made it through high school. I think that they really have put an emphasis on college, and I tried the traditional college route and it didn't resonate with me. And had the opportunity to go to Berkeley, whether I was ready or not. And it just seemed like an opportunity to kind of have a singular focus and, you know, try to learn some discipline and some focus, basically.
So two quick questions. One is, when you say you tried the traditional college route, what was your original path of study?
I mean, it was also kind of like a poor attempt at compromising going into the music business. And I went to a small school in Florida that had a music business program, but I mean, I never even touched it. Right. Cause it was, I was there for one semester. But that was kind of the idea, right? My parents were trying to guide me into something that seemed practical. You know, certainly at the time, you know, a career in music business was like, you know, you either become a rock star or you, you know, you play in a wedding band. As a guitar player, at least, like I wasn't even aware of. I mean, I think now there's so many other avenues to make money in music that I never had any idea about. And at the, you know, to your point, like I was only focusing on just being a guitar player. So, you know, that kind of meant playing in a band, playing sessions, which, you know, in Atlanta wasn't really a thing. Touring, teaching. So, and now, you know, it's a very small percentage of making, you know, a solid living doing any of those things.
Yeah. It's like a very, so, it's a very, right now the landscape is very flat.
It's, yeah. I mean, you got it. You have to kind of understand every trade soup to nuts. To just, you know, to kind of like spread it out to make it all kind of add up, really.
Well, I'm curious about, you know, your time at Berkeley. Did you go for music performance? Did you go for guitar?
I have a degree in performance, basically. Well, which again, you know, was short-sighted because it was all I could see was just play guitar, play guitar, play guitar. That's all I wanted to do, basically.
Well, when you're in your 20s, you're figuring that out, right?
Fair, yeah.
When you were at
Berkeley, 52, I think.
I'm figuring out in my 30s there, Lawrence. So it's, you know, we're in the same boat. But when you were at Berkeley, in regards to just like what you picked up there, were there any sort of lessons that you kind of like carried with you, or was like a good time to learn what not to do?
I mean, I learned how to learn, which was super important because that's a you know, if we're talking specifically about, you know, I think generally speaking, that's a great lesson, but specifically about music, learning how to kind of speak a language that enables you to pick up on things quickly and retain them is a pretty strong asset and skill when it comes to stepping into a a new situation and being able to kind of like keep up. But, you know, I mean, like any college experience, I think, you know, some of my closest friends today were friends I made then. So it kind of becomes a little bit of I don't know if this is a bad word, but like a networking tool, you know? I mean, like, you know, I wouldn't have moved to Los Angeles had it not been for a friend that I knew from Berkeley, you know, who knows what would have happened. So, you know, I think it's like, any of the, you know, you put yourself in situations and they kind of, you know, hopefully branch out into other things that you, you know, that kind of like guide the path that you go on.
Yeah. Well, I think it's cool that you had that experience and then you made it there. And I will say that on this show, there's been a number of times where artists will be like, is like business a dirty word? Is networking a dirty word? Like, no, these are these are things we have to be mindful of in any creative.
That's right. And I mean, listen, if you should be so lucky to, you know, live in a bubble where all of that stuff is taken care of you and you just, you know, somehow catch a wave and money is no problem and, you know, you become famous or whatever, or really well known for just doing one singular thing, then you're pretty stoked, basically. That's never really been my thing. Like I've always found that and maybe, you know, to my own fault, but you know, you become kind of jack of all trades.
Yeah. So. Well, and let's be honest, those people in those bubbles are way less fun to interview, Lawrence.
Fair enough. Unicorns, but nonetheless. So, but yeah, no, I mean, you know, sometimes in certain circles going, you know, being a music school guy or whatever person is, you know, maybe a bad word, but you know, at the end of the day, I have no regrets. I'm glad I did it. I don't think that, like anything, there were pros and cons, right? If had I not gone and I just decided to, you know, stay in a band with a, you know, a bunch of buddies, you know, going around playing bars around the Southeast, who knows what would have happened? But it didn't seem like it was heading anywhere positive.
Well, let's talk about your transition to LA. You you got there and became a session, like a studio guitarist ish.
I mean, that was the aspiration, right? I went with the aspiration of you know, picking up on, like, I went with the aspiration of going on tour. I wanted to tour and I wanted to play, basically. And, you know, the session thing, like everything in the music business at that time was, you know, everything was changing so dramatically. And, you know, even today, like the guys that kind of inhabit those pairs, if you will, of like the top session guys, very few. And I'm not afraid to say that my skill set doesn't even compare to some of these guys. You know, these guys can read, they can play multiple instruments, they're, you know, really got, like, that's a pretty unique thing. And the guys that are, you know, have been doing it for years and, you know, the first call session guys are real, like, it's pretty incredible. And now, you know, there's fewer of them because the way that records are made now is just far different. You know, records are made in spaces like this. You know, I mean, that business was set up, you know, predicated on these big major label record deals and records being made in those classic studios like, you know, the Ocean Ways of the world that is now called United. But, you know, these big L.A. studios, and it's just not the way records are made anymore.
Well, but what about, like, I mean, in that 90s landscape, there's like, you know, we've got the sort of Gen X thing going on. Like, rock is really popular at the time. You're mm-hmm. stepping into a world where there are all those studios, but it is still, to your point, like a highly competitive environment.
Insanely, you know, yeah.
What kind of gigs were you finding? And maybe they weren't music ones. Like, I don't know this part of your history.
I did everything from walking dogs and delivering sandwiches to going on the road with baby bands and vans for $500 a week, playing, you know, to nobody, to, you know, auditioning. The list is long of all of the cattle call auditions that I did. And I mean, I played with some great artists. And, you know, these were, again, like baby bands that needed a guitar player to get in a van, but you know, you never knew where that would go. The reason why I moved to Los Angeles is that I had a buddy who picked up a gig like that and happened to be Alanis Morissette. So, you know, I see that coming through Atlanta. The first time they come through, they're playing at a club in a van. And then, you know, a few months later, they're playing the Superdome. I'm like, I think I'm going to move to Los Angeles, 'cause this looks good. And had a few gigs with some promise, you know, started to get into the scene. And then And then the Boston's happened.
Yeah.
Shortly and thereafter.
What was
I mean, I moved to LA in 97, and although it felt like an eternity, and I did 1,000 things between 97 and 2000, but I joined the Boston's in 2000.
What was the sales pitch on that? I mean, you talk about, like, you know, I love the visual of, like, showing up to an audition and just being that guy who's like, I don't have the look for this. I got the skills.
That's what it is. It's like, you may as well show up with a headshot. I mean, it really is like, that was the vibe, which didn't agree with me at all. Like, we could talk for hours about the way that those things are constructed. But I wasn't good at that, basically, because the look thing, it was like, you know, it's like, you know, you have to become kind of, I don't know, it just always felt very disingenuous to me.
You got the wrong piercing and the wrong tattoo and the wrong haircut for
100%,
that
or like danced incorrectly in the audition. I mean, it was always a little bit. And whenever I, like, when my cheese meter would go off, I just couldn't help but, like, just, you know, yeah, wasn't my scene.
Well, tell me about getting discovered by the Boston. So Nate Elbert left the band, you know, and they were looking for somebody. And from what I understand, it was, like, hard to find you. It was hard to find that fit.
I think they went through a lot of auditions trying to find guys that could do both of the things that they did, basically the rock / punk rock stuff and the ska stuff. And I had, their manager was in LA at the time, and a buddy of mine who was kind of doing a similar thing had worked with their manager. The manager called him. He wasn't interested in it because he was doing more of the production thing, not interested in doing the touring thing. And so they called me. And then, you know, I didn't have any kind of like resume that made it make sense. And I'm sure that it was like, I think that their last resort was to go to Los Angeles and find, you know, a guy that was, you know, hadn't been in a punk rock band that was in their scene, that was just kind of like, you know, read like a ringer, you know what I mean? Like a session dude or whatever, not really a band guy necessarily. But, you know, I flew out there and auditioned, and then they gave me the gig, you know, before we were done with the audition.
That's amazing. What was the audition like? Like, what were you doing?
It was super random. I learned a handful of songs. It was the polar opposite of any of those other cattle call auditions, because it was in the band's rehearsal space that was at the base in the basement of a t-shirt making, I mean, like a 100-something-year-old basement, like just dingy as could be, small as, like, I mean, it probably like a 20-by-20 room or something like that, with 8 dudes crammed in there. And it was random. It was in January. It was freezing cold. And I kind of, like, leading up to it, I felt pretty out of place. I'm like, what am I doing back in Boston? But then I got in there and we played, and it was pretty magical. You know, it was pretty obvious once we started playing. And like, Dickie and I connected right away, and it was, you know, so it was cool. Like, I mean, basically, I flew out there for the audition and then didn't leave. Like, I was supposed to probably leave that same day, and I ended up staying out there. And like the next week I was in, this was right before Pay Attention came out. And I was out, then we flew to New York, and I was doing press with for everything for that next record, all the photo shoots and everything else. So it was kind of like, wow, like, that happened quick.
Did you feel like you were well integrated into that process? I mean, you hadn't worked on that record. Like, that must be such an interesting thing to be like, oh, hey.
I mean, I slid in the way. I mean, I'm pretty easy to get along with, and I'm pretty easy to, and I get along with other people pretty well. So it felt pretty natural, actually. So it was cool. I mean, look, yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, thinking about it, I haven't thought about this in ages, but thinking about it, and that was a pretty incredible how it all went down.
It's amazing. And I also love the fact that you have like the Boss Tones at the height of their popularity who are still practicing in the basement of a t-shirt factory.
Oh my God. It was as dingy as it got. I mean, we kept that rehearsal space for ages. I mean, that's where we did all of our rehearsing.
That's awesome.
For years. I wonder what's happening. I mean, God only knows what's going on there now. But yeah, I mean, listen, the Boss Tones were always at their core just, you know, your local band in a sense, right? Like nothing that glossy about the Boss Tones. But yeah, to your point, though, they were as big as they ever were at that point. And I don't know, you know, I think it was pretty well known that Nate was leaving once that record was made. And I think that they, you know, they kind of like tried to go to the press machine as though I was part of that record, which I was not. But also a lot of really complicated things were happening in the music industry at the time. And like their label that Let's Face It came out on was, you know, basically got folded into another Universal label. And, you know, I mean, this is like Napster, right? Like Napster's starting at this point. This is the beginning of the end, or the beginning of what we know as being kind of the norm now.
Yeah. Like the preview of what Spotify will be.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. That was 24 years ago.
It was. And I'm curious about, like, can you tell me a little bit about just finally having that dream of being able to like tour with the band? I'm really excited to talk a little bit about your songwriting, but I'm just curious about like that change in your lifestyle to like having that kind of steady gig and, you know, touring with the Boss Tones and what that was like for until 2003 or 2004, right?
In that first little chunk.
Right.
I mean, it was awesome because it was a world that like, I didn't think that I was, you know, I thought that, you know, like a lot of the people that I knew that were doing what I was doing were going into like, you know, like my pal was still doing the Alanis Morissette thing. And this is kind of like a pretty glossy, like, you know, pretty, I don't want to say cushy, but, you know, but like pretty mainstream, you know, and like that's kind of what I thought I was signing up for. And then I more or less joined a band, and, you know, which probably ultimately resonated with me more because now I'm kind of part of the band rather than just a hired dude in the background. So, I mean, it was exciting. I mean, you know, like it happened. I wasn't familiar with their world at all. Like, I didn't know anything about how they functioned. I didn't know what a Boston show looked like, you know, and, you know, all of a sudden I'm in this kind of like gang in a way, that, you know, like that whole punk rock world, you know, it exists completely outside of all of the, you know, like that whole Alanis Morissette thing is the complete dichotomy, basically, right? Like you got pop music and then you've got these, you know, like punk rock bands. And then, gosh, in 2000, I don't even know what else is going on. I can't even remember at this point. But it was awesome. I mean, I'm playing in front of, you know, it's, you know, we're not playing Saturday Night Live, but we are doing Letterman and Leno and things like that. And that was crazy exciting. I mean, that was everything I ever dreamed of, really. And then what was always fun about the Boss Tones shows is that everybody that was at a Boss Tones show, no matter how big or how small, were there to be at the Boss Tones show. And that's exciting. Like you can't replicate that. And I feel like I integrated pretty well. You know, I mean, I think there was always people that, you know, Nate was a huge personality in that band, obviously. But I think I was pretty well. I think I never felt out of place. So that was a good thing.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, by the end of it, you know, ultimately I was in the band longer than Nate was, really. But, you know, you could also argue that the impact that Nate had, you know, the impact the band had with Nate is far different.
Maybe. I mean, I think, you know, I am unabashedly a huge Muddy Muddy Boss Tones fanatic. And that's why I was really excited to do this. Like I always tell people that they're, you know, the discography that you worked on is my desert island discography. Like
that's awesome.
Yeah. And one of the things I was really enjoying about just doing the research on this is, one, I get to listen to the Boss Tones and not feel like I'm ignoring work. But, you know, just being able to all of a sudden look at just the amazing stuff that you guys worked on, and you in particular worked on what, 6 albums? Like,
starting with Jackknife.
Yeah, Jackknife to a Swan, Pinpoints and Gin Joints, Magic of Youth. What do we got? While we're
some
at
of
it,
the B-sides record.
Medium Rare.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I wasn't sure if you had worked on that one, but I'm curious about your
of those singles too. Some of which I produced.
Yeah,
like the What the World Needs Now and all that stuff.
Which is a wonderful recording. But I'm curious about like you sort of interject and you integrate into this, like, you know, I like the fact that you called the Boss Tones a gang with trumpets. As you do that, like, clearly your songwriting abilities start to integrate, and you're credited as having written what, 5 or 7 songs on Jackknife to a Swan, Mr. Moran, You Gotta Go, You Can't Win, The Punchline, 7 Ways to Sunday. I want to talk to you about one very specific song from that album, but like, what was it like to get your creative juices flowing and be a little bit more than just the guy playing the songs, like to really be a part of that creative process?
I mean, I think because of the role that Nate had, that I was, you know, kind of de facto in there. You know, listen, I don't know, this might be inaccurate, but you know, the real magic of the Boss Tones sound emanates from Dickie and Joe. I think they're the real kind of like DNA of the sound of the band. At that time, Dickie is always pretty hyper creative, and when he gets in the mode, it's go time. Like, you gotta hang on for dear life, and if you can't keep up, then you know, it's not a good thing. It's uncomfortable. So, but I was excited, right? Like, I wanted to be a part. That's something I wanted to be a part of. And Joe Gittleman at the time was pulling back a little bit. I think that he was starting to, you know, lose a little of the romance, you know, and he started to avoid one thing. So it kind of, and then there's kind of the dynamic of like, as Joe's kind of pulling away, Dickie's pushing even harder. So, you know, he's kind of like, I become a little bit of a pawn in the formula. But, you know, I took advantage of it and tried to write as many songs and tried to stay as true to kind of like, you know, me as kind of more of a budding songwriter, and them as a band that kind of already had a pretty well defined sound.
Yeah, and for people who are unfamiliar with the Boss Tones, which, come on, get on it. You know, Dickie's the lyricist and the singer. Joe's the bass player and are credited with most of the discography.
From them. There's no question. I mean, he's a hard driving force of that. You know, of the whole operation, really.
Yeah, well, let me ask you, and I'm sorry I'm asking you to take a trip back 22 years, but I'm just curious about, you know, I was so excited to realize that you were one of the driving forces behind I Want My City Back on the Jackknife to a Swan album. Love that song. I always feel like that's my, if there's like some project I need to do where it's like, all right, I need to pump up, like that is the one.
That's cool.
And I'm just curious about, like, can you tell me a little bit about the process of kind of like writing that song, if you recall?
I mean, I actually remember writing the riff in a hotel room, and I was listening to The Living End a lot, and somehow in my brain there's a connection between that and what I was hearing in The Living End. And beyond that, that's all I can recall necessarily in terms, you know, it's, you know, lyrically, it's Dickey always 100%. And I can't remember if I presented Dickey with the music and he came up with the lyric, or a lot of times the process was he'd write and then you'd take what he'd written and try to put music to it.
Interesting. And then what
So,
about, sorry.
good. No, you go.
No, what about the orchestration of the rest of the band? I mean, like the horn parts obviously are like such a driving force behind that song to kind of elevate everything. And I always appreciate the fact that like when I hear you play guitar and when I see the songs you've written, you're good about with restraint and you're good about like not having to show off to be like, this is my thing. Like it's very cohesive. Like how does that orchestration work with the rest of the sort of band members?
So a couple different ways, and this isn't specific to that song, but in the past I've written melodies and then the horns orchestrate it. And other times the horns just kind of take it and go with it. You know, I mean, there's obvious, like, you know, at some point there's kind of an obvious formula. You know what I mean? In terms of how that, you know, where the horns live and, you know, so, but yeah, a little bit of both. Like either the melodies are kind of pre-written as a kind of at least a guide, or the horns will kind of come up with their own thing and then arrange it and orchestrate it on their own.
And then in regards to just like this timeline or kind of any of the albums, like are you're saying, you know, you're writing this guitar riff in a hotel room. Is there pressure at that point to like, we need to write an album. It's time for us to crank out songs, or do things just sort of come together organically and you guys are building and building, building, hey, we have an album now.
A little bit of both, I think. I originally, you know, when I first joined the band for that first kind of burst, I was still living in Los Angeles. And then it was time to make a record. And then I moved, that's when I moved to Boston. And then 9/11 happened. I mean, it was like the world was, you know, kind of going to hell in a handbasket at the time. Be it the music industry or things outside of the music industry, which were having a pretty adverse effect on the music industry, i.e. touring. Like post 9/11, touring was like, you know, I mean, it was it really changed everything. I mean, it's funny to think about it because now kind of COVID did the same thing in a sense. But yeah, like, you know, 9/11 crushed the touring economy for obvious reasons.
Was it, and obviously, like logistics become way more difficult.
Well, right. Nobody wants to get on a plane, first of all. I mean, I can remember we did a gig in that was booked to be a fly-out gig. We took a bus because nobody wanted to fly. And I can remember driving past Manhattan, and it was close enough to the date that you could still see smoke coming up from the site. I mean, freaking eerie. And yeah, so like, you know, I mean, listen, everybody was rattled, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said about just like the collective trauma
That's
that
right.
you know affects all industries and especially creative procedures. Like, I think that's one thing like people kind of struggle to understand is that like the time at which we most need those things are the time
Well,
at
that's
which
right.
it's hardest to just sit down and create something because your brain is somewhere else.
Well, even if you look at it from an economics perspective, also, you know, it had such an impact on the economy that now people don't have, you know, money to go buy tickets to shows.
Yeah.
So that there's an effect there too. But again, you know, also to your point, like things that are, you know, kind of healing opportunities.
So the Boss Tones decide to kind of go on a hiatus in 2004, and I guess what I'm curious about is like, what was, you know, just as you being a member of that band and like just producing this amazing music, like, you know, you talked about it. People are starting to kind of to slow down, but as that slowed down, like for you, was that an opportunity for you to explore other things? Was that like a time where you were like, oh, there goes my gig? Like how did that?
I think yes is the answer to that question. I moved back to Los Angeles pretty quickly. Realized that, you know, kind of I'm a fish out of water in Boston. I moved back to LA and with the hopes of, well, now I've got a resume. So I'll, you know, this will kind of bump me forward a little bit. And looking for other gigs, I then joined the Goo Goo Dolls for about 5 minutes. 5 minutes that may have been 3.5 minutes. I'm not sure. I never played a show with them. I did a bunch of rehearsing with them and then got caught up in a decent amount of drama that ultimately had nothing to do with me and got fired. And at that point, I'm like, okay, I got to figure out a way where I'm not reliant on my phone ringing to work. Right? Because there's a lot of that. You're like, okay, well, I hope somebody calls. I hope I'm going to get hired for a gig because until then, you know, you're not working, basically. So that's when I decided to get into the studio thing. And then you know, at the time, now Pro Tools is pretty ubiquitous. You know, people are making music outside of the big studio structure. And having come from, you know, a mentality that everybody kind of has their role, you know, you've got your engineers, you've got your players, you've got your writers, et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, I better start learning how to do the other stuff now. So that was kind of that was the shift, really.
Well, that's what I was curious about is like, so, and you also start to a few years, what is it, 2006, you start to kind of get into doing licensed music and.
Yeah, music. I'm not sure where, like, I think short, like I built my studio as a place where I could do kind of session work out of and, you know, any other kind of projects like that. It was never an idea to build a commercial studio and still not. But and then the kind of before the licensing thing, it was like TV commercials. I had a buddy who was a commercial director and he brought me on to a couple of those. And, you know, those were kind of incredible. So I did some of that. And like then the licensing music is almost more current, really, at this point.
OK,
even more so than then, if I'm remembering correctly.
Well, tell me about building a studio, because like I always feel like the thing with like the I come from like the punk and hardcore DIY scene. And it's always like we need to record something. I'm going to learn how to record something. And then you get a four track or whatever. And you kind of figure those things out. And I think that's part of the beauty of studio work is that's why everybody's is so different because everybody's sort of figuring it out. But tell me about your process of building a studio. Like, I love the fact that like you were like, no, this is not going to be a huge studio space where I'm dealing with rock stars. Like this is going to be a place where I can produce music or work with small groups. Like, how did you find that space? How did you decide to angle it? Like, what was your goal?
I think that, you know, I mean, there's budget restraints, obviously, because gear is expensive. Space is maybe even more expensive. And, you know, that's just that, like getting in a into the commercial studio business is a pretty tough racket, right? Like you're hard pressed unless you have a space that, you know, that people are just clamoring to get into because you've got just the most amazing gear and the most amazing space and are doing the most amazing projects. So I think that for me, I was just, you know, kind of bare bones, just getting, you know, kind of the most practical yet quality equipment that I could get. I mean, I already had a ton of guitar gear, obviously. And then, you know, it was a time where all of this, you know, studio equipment was becoming more, you know, user-friendly in a sense, right? You didn't have to own a console. You didn't have to own, you know, a huge mic locker. So, and that's still how it is. And then just over the years, just kind of collecting the gear.
Interesting. What kind of, did you have any sort of mentor or anybody who's helping you through the process?
I think, yeah, probably. I mean, I think that there were things that were just like, you know, there were pieces of gear that were in every studio. That's like when I first started, like that was kind of the goal. Like you get the things that you see everywhere because they're good, obviously, or otherwise, you know, every studio has 1176s. Every studio has a version of a Neve, an API, you know, a Neve or an API, and, you know, et cetera, basically. And then figure out where you can afford what.
Awesome. So I want to ask you so many things, but the thing I'm really curious about right now is just because I'm on this Boss Tones kick is the Boss Tones like get back together in 2007. At what point did you start producing work for them? Like at what point did you start doing some engineering and recording?
Well, at that point I had my studio was starting to kind of, you know, I mean, like my joke was, is that like, if you're a guy in a band that has a studio, it's like you're the guy, you're the friend that has the truck when somebody needs to move. You know what I mean? So that's kind of how it went down, basically.
I've heard that joke about drummers as well, you know?
Exactly. So, right, you got the drummer has the place to play, exactly, or to practice. But, yeah, I mean, it just like, you know, that I had the studio. So it just made sense.
What kind of stuff did you guys record there? I mean, like, what did you do a full album?
I mean, we
there?
Did, I think all of that, I'm trying to remember, there were a bunch, all of that, What the World Needs Now was done in my studio. We did a ton of vocals for, what was the record before, the last one?
While we're at it.
Yes. While we're at it, I think almost, gosh,
you're listed as an engineer on that one.
We have a lot of, those vocals were done at my studio, maybe even some guitar overdubs. I mean, you know, even on the last record, which was a COVID record, basically, I was living in Philadelphia. I did all of my guitars in Philadelphia in my studio by myself. Not that fun. Yeah, while we're at it, we did a ton there. What the World Needs Now, we did all at my studio. Seems like there's other singles that I'm not even seeing on Spotify.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, I initially start off as, you know, I'm a guitar player, and then all of a sudden you're a guitar player and a songwriter, and then you're a guitar player, a songwriter, and an engineer. Do you find the same amount of joy between all those processes?
And producer and studio. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't, yeah, I think, I mean, like on some level, the guitar playing has kind of like slid into the backseat a little bit. You know, just not for any good reason, but other than just survival, really. You know, I mean, the guitar is my go-to instrument when I'm writing, and it's always kind of at the core of my DNA. But yeah, I like it. I like it's a little overwhelming at times, you know, like I didn't set out, you know, it's like part of the reason why it's overwhelming to me is that if I'm mixing a track, I guess that makes me a mixer. But if I'm looking at the guys that I see historically who are mixers and that's what they do, I don't, like, it's hard for me to even put myself, like, how would I call myself a mixer? If you're looking at, you know, like Chad Blake, like these guys are mixers, you know what I mean? Like that's all they do. So that's not to say that you can't do it, but, or that what I'm doing is not good, valid work. What it is to say is that how in the world can one person get to a skill level and an understanding and a knowledge of, well, my knowledge as a guitar player, like, how can I make my knowledge as an engineer, a writer, a producer, even compare to my understanding of being a guitar player? So at that point, you're like, you know, do you have enough room in your brain to understand all of these trades that are very, like, you know, on some level could be very singular pursuits?
It's interesting coming from somebody who's been in the business for so long that there's still that, like, I'm not there yet kind of mentality.
Well, I think that's, yeah, I mean, that's a life philosophy conversation, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, it's crazy because then you feel like you're super spread thin. So, you know, and it's, but at the same time, there's so many resources to, you know, to learn things now, right? But again, it's like, do you do a little bit of everything because that's kind of what you have to do? Or do you just say, all I'm going to do is be a mixer? I'm going to just eat, sleep, and breathe mixing. So, and you know, again, that's kind of a philosophical question, right? Like, you know, but the reality is that, you know, you kind of, yeah, I don't know how to summarize this other than to say that you're kind of, you're very fortunate if you say, all I'm going to do is this one thing, and I'm going to pour all of my energy into it, and hell or high water, this is what's going to work for me. This is just what I'm going to do.
Do you still get the same amount of joy out of doing these procedures as you did when you started?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's equally joyful and it's as it is, you know, challenging, and challenge can mean frustration. But yeah, I mean, they're all processes. So, you know, there's, you know, it's tension and release. Like, I don't even know how to make music to, wow, how did I just make that, you know, and everything in between.
Well, the reason I ask is I think that there's some time, like, for me, there's something about making music and constantly surprising myself and just like, oh, like, I didn't know that bass riff could come out of me or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And for people, and a part of me, and maybe this is just an ignorant belief in my own brain, is that part of the reason I find that joy and that surprise is because I make time and I make space to do that, and that's when it can exist, or something can linger in the back. But if I was doing that all the time, or if my financial well-being was reliant
well,
on that,
that's just right.
Would it take me out of that space?
100%. I mean, yeah, I mean, that's the chat. Listen, when art meets commerce, it's a whole ball of wax. And when, you know, and also when your escape becomes your reality, then what? So it's, yeah, I mean, those things, those are the challenges, you know, because those questions start to enter your creative process. Is this going to be, you know, does this fit the kind of paradigm of what could make money? Is this song equal parts good, integrous music with a process that is fulfilling as it is meet the requirements to potentially be in a commercial or on a TV show? So, you know, which in you could say in and of itself is a contradiction. But that's the world we live in. And that's one of the uses of music that, you know what I mean? That's one of the places that music gets used. And it gets paid, and they pay you for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's nice to take pride knowing that your music is something you are proud of, and it's in a Taco Bell commercial. Like, that's allowed.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's the thing, you know, I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not being in the Foo Fighters, but it's, you know, I set out to make a living as a musician. Maybe at some point in my journey, had I set out to do what Dave Grohl did, then maybe that's what I would have accomplished. But I mean, you know, talk about a unicorn.
Well, so that dovetails into a question I had for you about your personality versus performance. Like one thing that I think is really interesting about you is that like when I hear your voice and when I hear you talk, you're I don't know, there's a power and there's a force to it. When I see you play, you're so focused on what you do, and you're clearly enjoying the process, but you're not somebody who shows off a lot. You know, you're not somebody who's like really just like jumping and like making sure that you're the center of attention. And I'm curious about like how you feel your personality matches that musical life.
Well, I think that, yeah, I mean, listen, there's a certain amount of insecurity. There's a certain amount of I would rather be a little bit more, I'm more introspective ultimately. But I mean, I'm certainly outgoing, but I'm not the look at me guy. I never really have been. It just feels disingenuous to me. And you know, listen, like in a setting like the Bosstones, like I consider myself, I mean, first and foremost, I'm there to play the music, right? Like I'm there to translate communicate the message, if you will. And there's a certain engagement in that. But you know, I mean, look at Dickie. I mean, like, good God, I mean, he's the best there is at that. Like he is the guy. He's a front man for a reason. And I never wanted to be a front man. So I think there's a distinct personality difference in the roles. And I don't like I feel like I'm far from timid, but maybe I'm a little shy. But I also, like in the Bosstones context, just would rather, speak louder with, the music that I'm making in the moment.
That's awesome. You spoke pretty loudly, and over the years I've been listening to you, Lawrence. So thanks for that. So you are we there's so much to talk about. Like, so you do the band Foxworth Hall, which is kind of like a cinematic folk group. You've done that. You're in a group that's active currently called Whole Damn Mess, which released a wonderful album called The Queen and the Outcast in 2018. And you guys just released a re-recording of a thing called Into the Great Unknown, which is wonderful. But you oh, and sorry, and Graffiti Ghosts, you've got all these projects that are just wonderful. And in tandem with this podcast, there'll be a Spotify playlist that people can listen to enjoy your music. But
Awesome.
you have this wealth of knowledge from, as we pointed out, just this is how you focus time on guitar. This is how you focus time on songwriting. This is how you focus time on the recording process. So you've gotten to this point where you've offered to open your brain up to other people, and you're offering coaching opportunities for people who are interested in kind of either improving their own skills or getting a look into the music business or just fulfilling general curiosity. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're offering and what your goals are?
It's not, I've always taught guitar lessons in the past, here and there. I've gone through phases where I've done it more, I've done it less. I think that if I'm framing it in some sort of altruistic way, I think that, in being in service of other people is a good thing. And also in a just purely kind of realistic way, I'm just trying to expand everything that I do to, open up new opportunities. And if in those processes, it can be of assistance to people, then that's amazing. But, that's kind of it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if somebody's interested in what I do and I can help, then that's about as organized as it is going to be. I don't have aspirations of, creating a school or any sort of program that's available to, download for $5.95 a month on my Patreon. But if there are people that are interested in a conversation and have questions and want to learn things that, there are things that they think they can learn from me, then I'm wide open to it.
Can we just take a moment and acknowledge like how selfless and kind that is, though? I mean,
Well,
like I don't, I can't, I can't think of many other.
There's a bit of pragmatism in that too, by the way.
I'm sure there is, Lawrence, but like I think that we live in a world right now where you know, people identify that they have skills and they try to monetize those skills, and then they do the thing which is the part that worries me, which is they then figure out a way to automate those skills so that people can the people part can be pulled out of the equation, you know?
Sure.
And that's not at all what you're doing. You're offering yourself as a resource saying, let's have this interpersonal connection. Let's learn. Let me, you know, there's a business component to it, but like, I am willing to teach you one-on-one is not something that most rock stars would do.
Fair. Yeah. I mean, I've never thought of it in that sense, but yeah, it makes sense. And, you know, like, I don't know, the infomercial version of what we're talking about just has no appeal to me, right? Like, I don't feel like I'm like some sort of, you know, commodity that can be, you know, that I can be the face of my product. You know what I mean? Like that's not really my mission. And I prefer personal connection, to be perfectly honest, because, you know, otherwise, like, you know, it doesn't make much sense to me.
That's why you're a boss tone. You've got that, you know, that working class, just we're going to put our nose to the grindstone and get it done kind of approach to things.
Fair.
One other question for you, just before we start to wrap things up, which is, you became a dad 6 years ago. You've got a 6-year-old daughter, and, I listened to an interview with you, shortly after she was born. And I'm curious about how, being a musician and making art for a living, and now, you know, having a kid who may or may not be expressing interest in that has impacted you and your art. Like, what's it like?
It's amazing, obviously. It's quite a transition from having, you know, my wife is also an artist. Fortunately, she's got skills that can get us health insurance. but you know, it changed everything. Obviously, it completely rattled the cage. It got us out of Los Angeles, for better or for worse, probably for better ultimately. You know, there's a certain amount of selflessness that you have to have, and you know, this making music takes a ton of time, so you have to be slightly selfish. So I've had to kind of like sacrifice a little bit of that, because if it's not for the greater good of the family, i.e., you know, paying bills, then it slides down the priority list. But you know, she's getting to a place where you know, on some level, it's a bummer that she can't be exposed to more of the Boston stuff, because I would like her to experience me in that element, because that's, you know, my sweet spot in a lot of ways. And that doesn't mean that it won't happen with the Boston. It doesn't mean it won't happen with other things. But, you know, part of the design even of this space and having the studio in the house is that she can experience the creative process. And she, again, her mother is a fashion designer, so she sees it in that, from that angle as well. She, no surprise, is creative and shows, you know, creative, you know, traits. I'm excited for when this place really gets going, that she can kind of really be immersed in the music making process.
When you say this place, you mean your studio and your
home? My studio, correct. Yeah. So since we've lived here in COVID, obviously I'm not, you know, everything I'm doing is virtual. There's nobody coming into the house for obvious reasons. And then the space that I was in got flooded. So then I moved into another space in the house, and like, you know, until now, my studio life has kind of been crammed into a corner a little bit. So this is, you know, literally and metaphorically, more space to do this.
Awesome. It's really exciting, and I feel like we'll have another cats coming down the line that's going to be creating more amazing artwork, right? So as we wrap things up here, for people who want to find you and are interested in your coaching or just interested in sort of checking out your projects, what's the best way to hunt you down?
I mean, I would say the Instagram route, which is just my name. I believe it's Lawrence underscore Katz, LAWRENCE underscore KATZ. And, I look to see who's writing me. So I'm happy to communicate with anybody.
Yeah, I can verify that Lawrence will in fact answer your message on Instagram, and he will
That's
stalk you a little bit. So it'll go both
right.
ways. And then in regards to just things that are on your brain, things that you want to pump up, what types of is there anything we haven't talked about today that you want to throw out there?
I mean, a little bit about the whole damn mess thing. That's kind of a passion project. It's pretty streamlined pop music for the most part, I suppose, but imaginative and creative in but still kind of packaged in that accessible song box. That's a project that's pretty close to me. Something I've been doing for years, some music that I believe is probably of any of those projects that you quoted, probably the closest thing to my voice as a guitar player and a songwriter. So it's pretty sincere and authentic. And that's something that, we'll keep pushing as long as we can. And if it gets traction, it gets traction. If not, we're still kind of married to the process. That's good.
Yeah, and it's so I was reading the tagline of four producers writing, recording, and playing songs, and it's Don Miggs, C. Todd Nielsen, Greg Hansen, and you. And I love that Queen and the Outcast album. I mean,
Oh, thanks.
I just had I try to always do a lot of as much research on guests as I can, and that was that was the album I kept finding myself returning to in the weeks leading up to this, just trying to see what elements of the production process are in there. Because a lot of times you'll see side projects where the studio albums aren't they're not as as lovingly handled. And
Yeah.
as you listen to that album, there's so much going on with each track, and the themes within the album just sort of play nicely one track to the next. And the artwork is amazing. Like the artwork
Yeah.
on is just wonderful.
That record was unique in that there was a concept lyrically. Todd and Don and I had basically just met and started writing songs together, and it turned into that. And it became like, in some ways, I played everything that isn't drums on that record. And it's kind of just a raw version of what would come. Eventually, Greg would join the band, and then we became, excuse me, a bit more of a four-headed beast, for better or for worse. But I think there are kind of sophomoric beauties in that record that I don't know if sophomoric is the right word, but it was new and fresh, and we were just trying to figure out what it was. So I think that's like, in a lot of ways, bands' first records sometimes have that kind of mystique and, kind of allure. And I
Yeah.
think that one captures it.
And I feel like it's good to know what you're good at, and it's good to know what you're not good at. And I am terrible at determining genres for bands. Like I it's
Fine, yeah.
it and as I was listening to that, I felt like it was like eating an ice cream flavor and like knowing that you have familiar tastes there, but you can't quite pinpoint where the influences are. Which
That's
I think,
perfect. Yeah.
yeah, which was just a really nice experience while I was kind of absorbing that music.
Yeah, I think we, as much as we kind of like talked about where the, what the influences were, I think we were also just kind of following our noses. So
Awesome.
yeah, that was a great process. I loved making that record.
It's great. And I hope I see you guys are doing a thing right now, encouraging people to tell you guys where you want them to play. And I hope that we get to see you guys on the road a little bit more.
Yeah, dude. Well, we have a show coming up in, I don't know when this airs, but it's the show is March 8th in Nashville.
And that, unfortunately, that will be 20 days ago. But
hopefully
there will be more
Fair.
Coming up.
Indeed.
Well, Lawrence, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time.
Oh, man, no worries. It's my pleasure.
And the other thing I just want to say, and just, you know, not to be too cheeky, is that, like, I think that in the realm of music, and, you know, I hope that everybody who listens to this, or everybody, period, has that band that they feel they can connect to. But the thing that I always really loved about your work in the Boss Tones was the fact that it was clear that it was a project of passion for everybody. It was clear that it was longevity was the goal, you know, mm-hmm. that, like, we want to keep making music as much as we can. And also that sort of, like, as somebody who's from the Northeast, that sort of, like, Northeast working class sensibility, like, sure. We can survive a rough winter and we can burst out musically to demonstrate all the aggression and all the excitement that we have. And I just really want to, like, thank you and the rest of the Boss Tones just for demonstrating that type of work ethic and that type of music can have such an everlasting impact.
That's just awesome. Thank you. I mean, such is the in my mind, the purpose of music, right? Like, that's the objective.
Totally. And I always feel like there's so many bands that, like, they pop up, they burst into flames, it's beautiful, and then a bunch of people just survive on the royalties, or, you know, they don't tour anymore because they don't really like it. And I always feel like, you know, for me, I saw you guys in Rochester, we talked about this beginning of the show, but I saw you guys in Rochester in 2019, and I had seen you, I actually saw you in Seattle with Big Wig and Slick Shoes and Simple Plan, right when you had kind of first joined the band. 2002
at the Showbox, is that the name of the place?
I believe it was. And one of the things that show, you know, keep in mind, that the impression that I get was maybe 5 years old at that point. And it still was this, like, huge radio hit. And I remember being at that show, and I was, like, right in the front, and I was, my little 15-year-old self was just screaming every word, and some guy got on stage and started to just sing with Dickie for a little bit, and then kind of meanders way off as you would at a normal punk show. And that was, despite the fact that you guys were this huge, huge bit, that sort of, like, no, this stage is for everybody mentality.
That's right.
Was still,
I mean, that
there.
Was the beauty of the Boss Tones, is that, yeah, it was very inclusive.
Totally. And I think just by my dad, who is, you know, very used to seeing just traditional rock bands or whatever, like, he kept talking about that after the show. He's like, who was that guy? I was like, who cares who that guy was? Like, the stage was for everybody. And I think that mentality followed you guys through your entire career. And I am allowing myself to believe that there is more coming eventually. So
we will see. I guess never say never.
Absolutely. Well, Lawrence, this was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you. I appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Lawrence. I still can't get over the fact that A, he agreed to have a conversation, and B, that he just offers his services to anybody. So if you're interested in learning more about Lawrence's amazing work, I strongly suggest that you follow him on Instagram. And equally, I'm not nearly as cool, but if you're interested in learning more about the works that I do, you can find The World of Ryan Zlomek on Facebook and Instagram. Once again, The World of Ryan Zlomek on Facebook and Instagram, where I talk about my experience as an educator, my experience as a media artist, and, of course, making this podcast. Equally, if you're interested in learning more about the podcast, you should tune in on April 10th for the next episode. I'm going to have Nate Powell on the show. Nate is a cartoonist, a pretty important cartoonist, in fact, the only cartoonist to have won the National Book Award for working on the March trilogy, which he illustrated, written by Congressman John Lewis and Andrew Aden, about the civil rights movement. In this conversation, we talk about Nate's history in punk and hardcore with the band Sufi Nun Squad, where they were based in Arkansas. We talk about his experience publishing comics on his own. depicting the civil rights movement, working with politicians, and we talk about his latest projects, a book called Fall Through and another one called Lies My Teacher Told Me. It's going to be a fantastic conversation with a very, 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 very passionate cartoonist. So if you're interested in that, once again, April 10th with Nate Powell on the Meditations with Ryan Slomek podcast. And as always, as we close this one out, please make sure to make space for conversation because you just might learn something. Have a great day and stay awesome.